शयराधमाधव तुंज बिहारी गोपीचन बाल गिरधार धारी गोपीचन बाल गिरधार धारी यशोरनंदन व्रज जन रंजन यशोरनंदन व्रज जन रंजन यमुन तीर वन चारी यमुन तीर वन चारी हय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी
Vishnupad, Paramahamsa, Paramarajakacharya, Sotir, Sri Shri, Shrimad Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai, ISKCON Founder Charya, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai, Samaveda Bhaktivrinda, Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to some of the devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Sri Guranga, Jai Prabhupada. Namo Vishnupadaya, Krishna Prasadavade, Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Chinamani Namasi Sasadim, Gaura Varna Vitarani, Nirvishesha Srinivadi, Paschacharya Sitarani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So today we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 12, text 9. Atachitam samadatum na shakshnoshi maistiram abhyasa yogena tato mamichchaptum dananjanai Atachitam samadatum na shaknoshi maistiram abhyasa yogena tato mamichchaptum dananjaya. Another chant? Anyone else?
Thank you.
Thank you. My dear Arjuna, a winner of wealth, if you cannot fix your mind upon me without deviation and follow the regular principles of Bhakti Yoga, in this way develop a desire to attain me. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. In this verse, two different processes of Bhakti Yoga are indicated. The first applies to one who has actually developed an attachment to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by transcendental love. And the other is for one who has not developed an attachment for the Supreme Person by transcendental love. For the second class, there are different prescribed rules and regulations one can follow to ultimately be elevated to the stage of attachment to Krishna. Bhakti Yoga is the purification of the senses. At the present moment in material existence, the senses are always impure, being engaged in sense gratification. But by the practice of Bhakti Yoga, these senses can become purified, and in a purified state, they come directly in contact with the Supreme Lord. In this material existence, I may be engaged in some service to some master, but I don't really lovingly serve my master. I simply serve to get some money. And the master also is not in love. He takes service from me and pays me. So there's no question of love. But for spiritual life, one must be elevated to the pure stage of love. The stage of love can be achieved by practice of devotional service performed with the present senses. This love of God is now in a dormant state in everyone's heart. And there, love of God is manifested in different ways, but it is contaminated by material association. Now the heart has to be purified of material association, and that dormant, natural love for Krishna has to be revived. That is the whole process. To practice the regular principles of Bhakti Yoga, one should, under the guidance of an expert spiritual master, follow certain principles. One should rise early in the morning, take bath, enter the temple and offer prayers and chant Hare Krishna, collect flowers to offer to the deity, cook foodstuffs to offer to the deity, take prasadam and so on. There are various rules and regulations one should follow. And one should constantly hear Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam from pure devotees. This practice can help anyone rise to the level of love of God. And then he is sure of his progress into the spiritual kingdom of God. This practice of Bhakti Yoga, under the rules and regulations, but under the direction of the spiritual master, will surely bring one to the stage of love of God. So I think we could safely say that everyone in this material world is looking for happiness. That's pretty much a constant. Everybody, who wants to be miserable? Everybody wants to be happy in some way or another. And people look to find it in different ways. And this depends upon one's mode of nature that one is living in or one is acting in. So some simply try to enjoy the gross senses for happiness. Some might, through their work, find happiness. Others may do more intellectual pursuits or aesthetic pursuits to find happiness. And others might try to do altruistic activities or work in charity or help others as a way of getting happiness. These are all in different modes of nature. But I think that we would find that most people try to find happiness primarily through relationships. In fact, this is something that research has shown many times. I just saw some recent studies. There's one I just saw in, it was a study at Harvard, where they found over an 80-year longitudinal study they did that consistently over time, most people say they found happiness through their family and love relationships. So that's very common. You know, people through relationship are trying to find happiness. That's a very natural thing. So there's great expectation placed in that relationship, in the family, on the partner, on the loved one, to really fulfill that real sense of life happiness that people have. And therein lays the problem. Because our love relationships in this material world are by nature imperfect. Everyone is looking for the perfect love, the perfect soulmate, someone who will complete them, and the inevitable disappointment is they find out that their partner is actually flawed, that they're not perfect. They haven't married Radha or Krishna. So, in the very beginning, there's usually this time period of romantic love. Some of you may remember that in our youth. You know, when one feels that feeling of being in love, you know, just everything is wonderful. And it's a very, there's psychological studies on this. It's a very short period of time, usually about 1 month to 1 year. And that feeling, that surge of love that one feels, they've discovered has a lot to do with your oxytocin levels in your brain. So some of it is kind of a chemical reaction, you know, but not to say that there isn't some real relationships. But what happens is after that sort of romance time, what happens? One of two things. Either it really becomes more of a real relationship, a little deeper, based on some substance, or it dissolves. They fall apart and they look for a new partner so they can experience that again. So everyone's trying to experience that fresh, new love, you know. And it's very, very difficult to find. But we have this ideal. People think it's there. One of my favorite stories, classic love stories, is Romeo and Juliet. And it's one of my favorite stories because I think it's a classic case of total illusion. it's a great illustration. Now think about it. You all know the story. It's very brief. You know, it only lasts a little bit before any disillusionment period sets in. They're still not, you know, really romantic time of life. They're very young adolescents, extremely young, actually. I don't know what they are, 13 and 15 or something. So they have no life experience whatsoever of the world, have no prior relationships. They really don't know anything. And this love at first sight, you know, seeing someone on the balcony and you're madly in love forever. What is that based upon? Physical attraction, right? I mean, what substance was it? And the whole relationship, this undying loving relationship, was a total mental creation, right? Complete concoction. They didn't even know each other. I don't even know if they'd ever spoken more than once or twice, you know? So it's a complete idealization. It's a complete fantasy. And what's interesting about it is its totally unrealistic nature almost adds to its enduring popularity for over 500 years. Because it portrays an ideal that's not possible in the material world. If you call an ideal world where the two lovers kill each other, anyway, kill themselves, I mean, at the end of it. So, you know, I kind of don't get it. But anyway, be that as it may, it is an example of the sort of, you know, kind of illusory nature of what people expect in love in the material world. So it's full of disappointments. But, you know, everyone has expectations. Everyone is filled with all kinds of hopes and plans and desires. Nobody goes into marriage thinking that they're going to get divorced, do they? You know, they, oh, I'm going to get married next week. We'll probably get divorced, but that's okay. No, everyone thinks this is it. This is for eternity. And yet, 45 to 50% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce. And it would be a lot higher, except that so many people don't even get married anymore. You know, so they don't count the statistics. They just live together until they get tired of it and then find another partner. At any rate, excuse my cynicism, but, you know, it's not working very well. And, but, nevertheless, why? Well, we can get into that, but I'd say that the simple one-sentence answer is because most of these relationships are built on a material foundation. You know, and they do not have a spiritual substance which is going to hold a relationship together. But at any rate, the fact that we continue to look for these relationships, and not just love relationships, as parents, as children, as friends, as siblings, is not unnatural. It's not strange. It's not something, of course, why do people continue doing it? Because it is our nature. It's our nature because it's our spiritual nature. The prototype of all relationships is Krishna's relationships with his devotees. That's really the basis of all interactions that we see in this material world, or what Prabhupada called a perverted reflection of what happens in the spiritual world. The difference is, of course, is the material world is this imperfect reflection of the spiritual world, and while material relationships resemble those in the spiritual world, they're incomplete. They're subject to the creation of both happiness and distress. We cannot be free of the dualities of the material world. Sometimes there will be happiness, and sometimes there'll be distress. And you really, it's almost out of your hands which way it goes, due to our past activities and our past karma, whether there'll be happiness or distress. So We are advised throughout the Vedic literature, and Srila Prabhupada is telling us here in this purport and in so many places, better that we look not in this material world, but in the spiritual world for real happiness, relationships, and best to try to find that relationship with Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because Krishna is the origin of all. He's the origin of love. He's the origin of relationship. He's the origin of rasa. He's the origin of the material world, the spiritual world, everything. There is nothing that is not part of Krishna. He says, Ajopi san avyavyatma bhutanamishvaropi san prakritim sva adishtaya sambhavam yatma mayaya. Although I'm unborn and my transcendental body never deteriorates, and I am the Lord of all living entities, I appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form, Bhagavad Gita 4.6. What does it mean? It means when Krishna appears as he did 5,000 years ago in Vrindavan, India, and as he appears in other incarnations and avatars throughout history, recorded and unrecorded history, he does not appear in a material body. He appears in his own transcendental spiritual body. And that's something that's very important to understand. It's his original transcendental form. Often you hear some of the acharyas, they write up and they say when Krishna appears in a human-like form. In other words, he appears as a human being. He appears like a human being, but he doesn't share the material features of human beings, like being subject to birth and death, subject to disease, subject to that. Sometimes he imitates. I guess imitates the right word. He performs pastimes which are like humans' activities, but they do not have the same qualities because they are all done by his will, for his pleasure, for his pastimes, rather than being forced by the laws of material nature and more or less having to accept whatever reactions are there from material energy, actions and reactions from karma, etc. So he's independent. He is completely free to do as he wishes. So he comes. And why does he come to this material world? Well, he comes, of course, Bhagavad Gita says for three purposes: to protect the devotees, annihilate the miscreants, and reestablish principles of religion. But Prabhupada is quick to point out it's primarily for the devotees that he comes. You know, demons, he could have an earthquake or anything, get rid of them, you know, by material nature, quite simply. He comes primarily to give pleasure to his devotees, to have relationships with them, to enjoy with them, and to show and exhibit those beautiful, attractive activities for the rest of the world to become attractive, and for his devotees to see those and hear them. You know, I remember when I first joined the temple way back in the 72 in the early days. They would always read. Prabhupada had just printed had the Krishna book printed. So here it is, we're brand new, we know nothing, really much philosophy, and he's giving his 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the most intimate, highest pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. I don't know what we understood, but we love them. You know, we'd read them at night, right? You remember it. You people remember that, you know, hot milk and reading Krishna book? Yeah, I know it sounds like, yeah, in the good old days. Sorry, yes, old geezers, you know. But, it was nice because everyone is attracted to Krishna. That's what his name means. Krishna means all attractive. And his pastimes and the stories about him were so nice. Even if we didn't fully understand all the philosophical imports, we knew this was God. We knew this was very special. We knew this was very wonderful and very attractive, very sweet. You know, in fact, I just started reading Krishna book again. I hadn't really read it through for many, many years. You know, I have so many books to read. You know, and it's wonderful, isn't it? It's wonderful to sit and just hear these pastimes, especially as Srila Prabhupada relates them so clearly and simply. It's very, very nice. So, back to the topic at hand. Krishna's form is eternal, so are his relationships. Those relationships are eternal. So when Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yashoda appear as his parents in this material world, it's not because they somehow, through their karma, qualified. No, there is eternal parents. They have an eternal relationship. They come with him. I mean, it's like, what Prabhupada says, like a road show or something. In other words, Krishna wraps up the material world here 5,000 years ago, and then he goes on to the next universe where it's time for him to appear. It's all by his schedule. It's his schedule. but he goes universe after universe, and his entourage comes with him, right? Naturally. You know, like some rock star, you know, travels around, all these people come with him, right? So he has his, the Yadus, he has, you know, everybody, the Pandavas, he has Mother Yashoda, and of course, Radharani and the Gopis, all with him. So these are eternal associates, and relationships are eternal. Now you might say, well, what about us? Well, you know, we don't seem to have that same eternal relationship, as here we are floundering in this material world, been here for I don't know how many lifetimes, thousands and millions of lifetimes perhaps, completely, you know, we're sort of on the bad list, you know, that left the spiritual world, decided to come here and give it a try very unsuccessfully. But so when we come back, when we go back to Godhead, which we will, you will, this lifetime, next lifetime, we will go back to Godhead. It's guaranteed. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has already saved us all. Srila Prabhupada has saved us all. When we go back, we will, and well, there may be a few rare souls among you, but most of us are what's called sadhana siddhas. That means through the practice of devotional service, we get purified and we qualify, and we'll be there with those eternal associates who've been with him forever. And Prabhupada said, you know what the difference is? None, once you get there. Really, seriously, once you get there, hey, it's like, welcome back. You know? Some of you have probably read the... Sanatana Goswami... Brihadbhagavatamrita. That's called a senior moment, you know, for you young people. You know, I only just read the whole book. Okay, so Brihadbhagavatamrita. You'll remember when Gopal Kumar, at the very end of the book, he goes through all the planets, all the universes. He finally gets back to Vrindavan. He sees Krishna. Now, of course, he's probably an ever-liberated soul. But in the story, he's going through all. He comes back. What has happened? Krishna embraces him and says, "You've been gone so long. I'm so happy you've come back." I thought that was such. I love that part. You know, it was so to me so encouraging that Krishna just says, "Welcome back." He didn't say, "Why have we been out in the material world so long?" He says, "It's so good to see you. You know, it's been so long." And that's how it is. Then it's just like you're back with the family. You know, and so anyway, that's part of the wonderful life that is ahead of us in the pursuit of Krishna consciousness. So these Vrindavan pastimes were seen 5,000 years ago, and they're enacted eternally, both where Krishna appears in material worlds and, of course, eternally in Goloka Vrindavan in the spiritual world. And those are, as we say, the prototypes of the human relationships. So we know Krishna has basically five main rasas. I'll just read from Prabhupada, it says in Adi Lila 1156. In the spiritual world, there are five kinds of relationships with the Supreme Lord: Shanta, Dasha, Sankhya, Sakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. The perverted reflections of these rasas are found in the material world. Land, home, furniture, other inert material objects are related in Santa, or neutral, or a silent sense. Servants work in the Dasha relationship. Reciprocation between friends is called Sakya. The affection of a parent for a child is Vatsalya, and the affairs of conjugal love are Madhurya. These five relationships in the material world are distorted reflections of the original pure sentiments of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So as I said, it's natural that we desire these relationships because those are there originally in the spiritual world with Krishna. So, as we said, Krishna has a spiritual body, and the residents of Vrindavan and basically in all the Vaikuntha planets and the whole spiritual world also have spiritual bodies. Now, there are transcendentalists, yogis, jnanis, etc., who do have some understanding of the nature of spirit, but it's an impersonal understanding, and they think God is an impersonal, and therefore the soul is also impersonal. So they may see that their God is an energy, or a light, or an abstract force, or sometimes it's a concept, such as love. You know, just sometimes people say God is love. You think, well, what does that mean? Sometimes it's kind of like it's some sort of emanation of an abstract force of love that's just kind of beaming or something. No, God is a person. He has feelings. There's reciprocation. There's relationship, rasa, you know, not just some abstract, you know, like energy source or something, you know, like that. So the spiritual body is not understood very well by most people. I'd say this is probably one of the great contributions of Krishna conscious philosophy and this Vedic philosophy to the world, the understanding of actual spiritual nature. So we and Krishna are Satchitananda Vigraha, the form of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. In other words, there is a form that is there, and that's the original spiritual form of God that is the source of all other forms, all other incarnations. As we know, Krishna is Tu Bhagavan Swayam from Third Canto Srimad Bhagavatam. I think I spoke about that at great length in my last class, probably to everyone's, distress. But it's such an important concept to understand that Krishna is that original spiritual form of God, and the living entity, while very minute, has similar spiritual nature. So we have the same nature. We have the same qualities as God, but very small quantity. So currently, and this is the other main difference, God is always in control. God doesn't forget who he is. God doesn't get covered by matter. He creates matter. He controls matter. We do. Living entity, the jiva, the atma, is tatashta shakti. That means we can become covered, and we do. When you come to this material world, we get covered by the gross and the subtle body. But the spiritual form is still latent there within us. Srila Prabhupada says in Beyond Illusion and Doubt, a little book from some of his lectures, the spirit soul is now within the material body, but originally the spirit soul had no material body. The spiritual body of the spirit soul is eternally existing. The material body is simply a coating of the spiritual body. Brahma-Bhuta is attained when we no longer identify with the material body, but with the spirit soul within. When we come to this platform, we become joyful. Brahma-Bhuta-Prasanatma. And then Srila Prabhupada makes the point, the material body is formed after the spiritual, around the spiritual body, says like a glove around a hand. Okay? So, in other words, we have this sort of human body, but there is a spiritual body that also, well, doesn't necessarily have a human-like form. It could have a cow form or a peacock. You know, it could have other forms, but it has some form. You know, and that form depends upon the desire of each of us, of each living entity. It's not like, oh, you have to be this and you have to be that. No, what we are is what we are. It says we have the eternal spiritual body, and that simply becomes uncovered. It becomes realized, and we become reestablished in that relationship with Krishna within that particular form. And it's perfect for each person. You know, and whether you are a devotee of Nrisingadeva, like Prahlad Maharaj on his planet, or Ramachandra, or whether you're a devotee of Narayan on the Vaikuntha planets, or whether you're as fortunate as in our Sampradaya to be a devotee of Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan, every one of those devotees has Krishna Prema. So make no mistake about it. They all have pure love of God. It's the particular relationship, the particular form, the particular rasa that we enjoy. And, you know, of course, we're all very... Anyway, I just think we're just incredibly fortunate that Srila Prabhupada brought us to the lotus feet of Srila Radha and Krishna, Radha Shama Sundar. Anyway, so when this body dies, what happens? It's stated that when a living entity gives up this material embodiment and enters into the spiritual world, he revives his spiritual body. In his spiritual body, he can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. He can hear and speak to him face to face and understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead as he is. Pretty nice, huh? But how do we do that? How do we achieve a spiritual body? Well, Prabhupada told us in the purport, and I think it was the last paragraph, through the practice of Bhakti Yoga. He explained that there are two different types of people, one who has already attained that state of loving relationship and those who are trying to attain that state. So to attain that state, Prabhupada says, because of our ignorance of the spiritual body, of which we have no experience, we do not know the activities of the spiritual body. If by Krishna's grace we act in our spiritual body, we can transcend the gross and subtle bodies. In other words, we gradually train ourselves to act in terms of the spiritual body. So we actually do spiritual activities through these material bodies, and then the material body and senses become spiritualized. Devotional service means engaging the spiritual body and spiritual senses in the service of the Lord. When engaged in such activities, the actions and reactions of the gross and subtle bodies cease. Now, of course, it takes a little time. It's not necessarily immediate, Prabhupada explains. It's kind of like I pull the plug on the fan, it'll take a little while for it to wind down. That's our karma winding down, you know, all the reactions and like that. So it may take some time, but still, in a sense, it depends upon one's perspective. Because the nectar of devotion, Bhakti Samrita Sindhu says that one of the, you know, there's the six signs of devotional service. One of the first ones is that all suffering is immediately destroyed, right? Klesha, what's that klesha, Vig? Anyway. That one. Okay, so, and then they say, well, how can it all be immediately destroyed? He says, well, relatively speaking, is actually, he said, if you take a needle and you had a stack of palm leaves, remember this is 500 years ago, analogy, you take and you put the needle through the palm leaves, it's immediately gone through. But if you kind of look at it, they don't have slow motion photography then, but it's kind of like what he's saying. If you look at it very, very slowly, it's going through one, then the other, then the other, then the other. So, in a sense, from our time perspective, being these little human beings on this planet, it may seem like it takes a little time to become completely purified and be able to go back home, back to Krishna. But actually, in sort of the time span of eternity, it's a tiny little moment. Tiny moment. Just like the needle immediately going through the stack of leaves. Okay. So, simple process to achieve this. 9:14 Bhagavad Gita, always chanting my glories, endeavoring with great determination, bowing down before me, these great souls perpetually worship me with devotion. So this verse gives a formula for spiritual life. Three things. In the process of devotional service, first hearing and chanting, satato kritayanto mam, then dhritavrita, engage in service with determination. So hearing and chanting, but also service, you know, engaging oneself, you know, and being a little determined about it. And then bhakta nitya yukta upasthate, mood of devotion. It says it worships him with devotion. It has to be the right mood. Mood of devotion means what? It means Krishna, I am your servant. Simply engage me in your service. Let me give my life. The Prabhupada said, so many lifetimes we've given to Maya. Give this one lifetime to Krishna. Of course, it sounds easy. sometimes it may seem like a struggle. But actually, it's not so much. Because, and I think the older you get, the more you understand this material body really is a bad bargain. And, you know, it's, we have nothing particularly hopeful to look forward to after a certain point. But Prabhupada said we are materially pessimistic but spiritually optimistic because we think, well, we're just getting closer and closer to Krishna. You know, we have just a little time left, perhaps, you know, to be able to rejoin Krishna in the spiritual world. So the process of Krishna consciousness begins with hearing and chanting about Krishna, as we hear so often. And as one increases one's hearing and chanting, increases one's service desire, it's a mutually reciprocal type of process. A chanting reawakens the dormant love of God and begins our relationship with Krishna. Our relationship with Krishna starts almost from the first time we chant Hare Krishna, right? Because Krishna is none different than his name. We are glorifying Krishna. We are hearing and chanting about him. A relationship is developing. We may only be dimly aware of it, but it's happening. It's there, and Krishna is observing it. And even if Krishna's not observing it, Radharani is. Prabhupada said, Radharani presents us to Krishna and says, Krishna, there's this very nice devotee down in Lachwa who has been chanting your name. You know, that, and he goes, oh, thank you, very nice. Or something of that nature. I don't know what they say. But at any rate, Prabhupada said that Radharani presents us to Krishna and our devotional service is accepted through her and goes to Krishna. So it's very, very nice. So the results of perfecting sadhana bhakti is eventually elevation to the spiritual world. a couple quick points I wanted to make. Also understand the basis of love between Christian and living entities is based entirely upon free will. One might say, well, why is there free will? Doesn't that just make us suffer in this material world? Why doesn't Christian just create us to always love him? Because it wouldn't be love. And yeah, I had a little, anyway, I don't have time, but I had a whole discussion here where Prabhupada was saying, you know, you would lose your independence if Krishna forced you or made you, you know, that you had no choice. Prabhupada said, that is force. Is it love? He says, you love me, otherwise I will kill you. Is that love? So Krishna does not want you to become a lover like that on the point of a revolver. You love me, otherwise I shall kill you. That's not love, that's threatening. Love is, Prabhupada says, reciprocal, voluntary, good exchange of feeling. Then there is love, not by force. So, of course, you have a choice. And if you choose not to love Krishna, then there may be consequences. You may have to stay in this material world and suffer. But it's not Krishna's desire that we stay in this material world and suffer. It is Krishna's desire that we come back to him and join him. It's explained that Krishna has an ever-expanding desire for rasa, for relationship, for love. In other words, it's not just... How to say this? Sometimes we think that, well, Krishna is sort of the reciprocal, you know, I'm serving Krishna and he's loving me like, you know, he just has to love me kind of. No, it's not mechanical. It's very much a matter of relationship. It's a matter of exchange. So, in other words, Krishna becomes attracted to our love and he desires it. Krishna actually desires, he wants us to love him. He doesn't need us to love. That's the difference. He doesn't need us. He's Atmaram. He's self-sufficient, self-satisfied, complete in himself. And at the same time, he wants us to love him. And of course, that is for our benefit as well. That's part of his great compassion to us, that he extends himself in so many ways through the scriptures, through sending the pure devotees, the acharyas, coming as an avatar, coming himself to bring us back so that we can get out of this material world of suffering. So, our primary purpose is to reestablish our loving relationship, and it's reciprocal. That love can become so great, and it's so nice that Krishna actually allows himself to be controlled by the love of his devotees. That's kind of interesting. Krishna says, I'm controlled by my devotee's love. Well, is he really controlled? He is controlled because he allows himself to be controlled. You know, it's, in other words, he wouldn't have to, but he likes it that way. It's kind of like, you ever seen some very permissive parent, father, mother, says, oh, the child's got you completely controlled or something like that. Well, no, the parent has complete control. They've got all the money, all the power and everything. They're allowing themselves out of their sense of love or whatever, whether it's right or wrong, you know, like that. Maybe not a good example. But anyway, some really wonderful examples of that. The story of Devasa Muni and Ambarish Maharaj. When Devasa Muni, of course, very, very unfairly curses Maharaj Ambarish, who was a great, great devotee of the Lord, and what happened was Lord Krishna, Vishnu, and Narayan defended him by throwing his Sudarshan chakra at him. So what happened? Chasing Devasa Muni all over the universe. He goes to this one, that one. No one can help him. He goes to Krishna finally, and he says, don't come to me. You go back and apologize to Maharaj Ambarish. He says, I can't do anything about it. And then he says, and this is in Canto 9, Chapter 4. It's a series of chapters from verses 63 to 68. Very, very nice. 63 says, the Supreme Personality of God had said to the Brahmin, I am completely under the control of my devotees. Indeed, I am not at all independent. Because my devotees are completely devoid of material desires, I sit only within the cores of their heart. What to speak of my devotee? Even those who are devotees of my devotee are very dear to me. So keep that in mind. If we can become dear to Srila Prabhupada, you know, have a chance. Then he says in verse 68, the pure devotee is always within the core of my heart, and I'm always in the heart of the pure devotee. My devotees do not know anything else but me, and I do not know anything else but them. So it shows his deep love and affection for those who are surrendered to him. And that pure love can be, as I said, even put Krishna under the control. Another wonderful example, of course, is Mother Yashoda, the famous story. And we will actually be soon celebrating, and during the month of Damodar, it's such a wonderful story, Mother Yashoda binding Krishna. And of course, he finally allows her to bind him because of her great love for him. And then Shukadeva Goswami summarized that by saying, "Oh Maharaj Parikshit, this entire universe with its great exalted demigods like Lord Shiva, Lord Brahma, and Lord Indra is under the control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yet, the Supreme Lord has one transcendental attribute. He comes under the control of his devotees." So this is Krishna. All-powerful, but yet becomes the sweet child of Mother Yashoda, allowing her to exercise that Vatsalya Rasa and to bind him. You know, it's I was just reading last night the story when the boys in Balaram accused Krishna of eating dirt. They all get, and he says, "No, they're lying. I haven't eaten dirt." And he says, "Well," and he says, "just look in my mouth if you don't believe me." He says, "All right, open your mouth." Opens his mouth, and what does she see? The universal form, all the planets, everything, all the presiding deities. She sees herself. She sees everything. She gets completely overwhelmed, bewildered, and she starts thinking very philosophically. She says, "Under illusion, I am thinking. I am the queen of all these subjects. I am the wife of Maharaj Nandan. I am the mother. But actually, you know," so she's all this high philosophical thinking. And then Krishna says, "No, this isn't what we want. This isn't. So then he covers her again with yoga maya so she can again resume just thinking, "Krishna is my beautiful young boy, and I have this wonderful relationship of love with Krishna." And Krishna is so happy and so satisfied with that. So only devotees' love can control Krishna. Nothing else can control him. And these spiritual relationships are so unique and so important. And it's actually very good for us to read about the great devotees who have these relationships, because we get a glimpse of it. We get a taste of what spiritual relationships are and what spiritual life is like with Krishna. And I was thinking, how does spiritual relationship? I'll end on this, let you go to Prasadam. How are spiritual relationships different from material? Well, first of all, they're eternal, where all relationships come to an end in the material world. The love is ever increasing. It gets more and more. Often in material relationships, it tends to decline over time. Sometimes it gets lost altogether. A total absence of envy, or an absence of any bad feeling or anger or negativity towards the partner. And there's no change of feelings toward it. And there may be different moods, but there's never lessening. And there's no personal motivation. In spiritual love, one only thinks of the other person. That's why it's considered pure. Because, you know, and the exemplars of this, of course, were the gopis. Because their only desire was Krishna's happiness. You know, they would worry about him hurting his tender feet, you know, walking on the thorns in the Vrindavan forest. And that wasn't, they seriously were. I mean, you know, it's like Mother Yashoda was too. Even though Krishna's Supreme Personality of Godhead, he's killing demons every day. But, you know, they're worried about his tender feet. So, I mean, this is the nature. And it's very, very wonderful. And so somehow or another, if we can get through these material conceptions of life and sort of fix ourselves on hearing and chanting about Krishna, remembering Krishna, trying to remember his pastimes, his relationship with devotees, and also devotee relationships. I had a whole other part which I don't have time for. I was going to say Krishna's also never alone. We also have to look at relationships with devotees, but that's for another day. Okay. Thank you very much. Any quick comments, questions, anything?
I was very surprised that the way you presented one of the controversial, I would say, whether that love for Godhead is inheritance or inherited. It's like a big topic about it, whether inheritance or inherited.
Well, I just
but the way you presented it is so said. Convincing. No, it's very nice, very well prepared. Okay. So I appreciate that a lot.
So you agree with that it's inherent quality within the living entity?
Correct.
Yeah.
Because I found many verses reference to that.
Yeah. Somehow I know there's a controversy about that. I missed it somehow. I just kind of remain ignorant and try to just, you know, stay in my own little world.
I have a little small note. On Bhagavad Gita 424, Brahmarpanam Brahmahovit, the famous verse, it says about compositional sense versus application sense. Application sense. So this body, this material body, you explained, made of material components. Earth, air, water, fire, ether. And then Satchidananda body is spiritual.
Yeah.
Spiritual substance, nothing about matter.
Mm-hmm.
But application sense means how we utilize the material body I have when I'm engaging. Right now I'm listening, I'm in temple, chanting, so I'm spiritualizing.
Yes.
When it becomes, now you said something, maybe I missed it, that when I'm spiritualizing and I'm developing a reciprocal relationship with the Lord, now does it determine that that's where my relationship in spiritual body, or this is just a transitional?
Well, that's a good question. Vishwanath Chakrabarty and Jiva Goswami both written about the fact that there's, and others too, Rupa Goswami, that there's different forms of devotional service. And some we perform within this material body that's called Chaitasarupa Bhakti. And then there's that which is in our pure spiritual body, which is Bhava, you know, Bhava Rupa Bhakti. So we're most often probably more in the Chaitasarupa, you know, where we're acting within this material body, spiritualizing the body. I mean, Prabhupada gave the example of the time, you know, like the hot iron, piece of iron you put in the fire, it becomes like fire. So even though this is a material body and senses, because they've been engaged in Krishna service, then they become spiritualized in the same way. They're acting as spirit. So in other words, the real difference between matter and spirit is its connection with Krishna, isn't it? Right? In other words, if I see everything is coming from Krishna, and I'm using everything from Krishna, then how's it different than spirit? You know, but are we actually fully situated within our sarup, our eternal spiritual body? Probably not at this point. Maybe beginning a little. So yeah, so there is some I mean, that's part of the stages of bhakti. There is a transition up to the point of, you know, bhava, prema, and like that. So I don't know, maybe I'm confusing the question.
No, that's very good. 15.7, I don't know if you gave it as a reference. 15.7, I remember Prabhupada put in a middle of the purport a verse, Pratishtha Sabayesha Brahmanishtha. The verse translation is that when the, after dissolving this material body, a spiritual body is being awakened. So it's like a very, like a, what is that means? It means it's already there. Otherwise, it would not be revived. Yeah. I think he used the word revived.
Doesn't Narada Muni give the example? When lightning he left his body,
lightning and thunder,
gave up and this, the other one he took right on, or something like that, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there is a transition from the material to the spiritual body, yeah. I mean, I guess we'll have to wait and see how that works.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Prabhu, for your class. There was one point that you mentioned that I was appreciating, that love is always free will and that it can never be forced.
Yeah.
And so Krishna doesn't just put a revolver up to our head and say, love me or die.
Yeah.
So at the same time, I have a question about that, because if we choose not to love Krishna, we come to this material world to suffer.
Yeah.
So I guess I'm wondering, it does feel, maybe, at least in my mind right now, and I'd appreciate some clarification, a little bit like, love me or go to the material world. Love me or go to prison. Like, love me or go and suffer.
Well, it's
so
interesting.
Could you clarify that?
Like, well, it's interesting because I didn't read the last part of the conversation, because when you said it can be a force, then the Pina who was asking says, but isn't it force anyway? Because if we don't love Krishna, we'll suffer. And Prabhupada said, that is your business. You'll suffer, but Krishna doesn't force you. He says, you love me, you'll be happy. If you don't love, then you'll suffer, but that is your business. That is your choice. So in other words, and it kind of evolves around a lot, there's so many long discussions about, is Krishna partial? You know, because he favors his devotee, does he not favor his devotees? So it's kind of in the same way. He gives everyone what they want. He says to each, right? You know, everyone, to each one, however you act, you get. In other words, I respond accordingly. You know, and so if you don't want Krishna, and you say, I don't want you, Krishna, I want to try it on my own. I want to be in this material world. I want to be controller. I want to be the enjoyer. Okay, give it a try. He lets you. So there's a difference between sanction and desire, is the way I understand it. Krishna sanctions us being in this material world and knows that we will probably suffer here and kind of tries to warn us, but if we want to do it, he's going to allow it. He allows us to, because it's our choice. It's what we wanted to do. Now, did we know it in full? You know, no, of course we were in ignorance. I mean, that's the nature of avidya, that we don't know, and hopefully now we are getting, we're removing that ignorance, that avidya, you know, by our experience and through higher spiritual knowledge. So now, we just say, would we make that choice? I hope not. Probably not. Most of us, from what we, the position we're in. However, the free will is there. Prabhupada also said that. The free will is there. Yeah.
Thank you.
Richard, did you have a question? Well, you have the mic?
Oh.
Battery died. You have to speak up. You know my hearing.
It's kind of like we have children that we love very much, but they might go off and we might say, don't do it. You know, please. It's not going to be good for you. And still, with the free will, they'll still go and do whatever and maybe get smashed like anything for doing it.
And you'll still love them and you'll still welcome them back when they learn better.
And it's painful. For the parents.
Exactly.
And it seems the same with Krishna.
It's
free will that we have, and Krishna doesn't want, but we have to try it.
I think that's a great example. Thank you. That's a good analogy. Yeah. Finally, we'll get back to Makanda.
Thank you, Prabhu, for the class, and Bhaktilata for the question. I just was coming just now actually from repairing a car for a devotee, our dear Panibhushan Prabhu, and we just replaced the whole steering rack. So what comes to mind is alignment, engagement.
You're going to work this
yes,
in? Okay.
The whole alignment issue. So it's like parts of a car, like we are part and parcel of God and we have this free will, but a specific part for a specific car is designed to fit with all the other parts with a certain alignment and engagement and like torque specs so that it gets into the right place and stays in the right place to function over time.
Yeah.
So my realization is that feeling, form, and function are designed to keep us in favorable conjunction with the will of God.
Yeah.
So it's really through this connection, then correction and direction that we assure our own happiness by making it one with the Lord's happiness.
Should write an essay on that. I like that.
Just now coming. Yes.
Okay. Develop that. Thank you. Connection. Yeah. That reminds me of, Don Mahan, used to be a mechanic, and he always had all of these car analogies for how the spiritual material world worked. Anyone else? Okay. Thank you so much. All glories to Prabhupada.